Welcome to Week in Review, a recap of this past week's events and issues pertinent to Central Illinois. I'm WMBD News' Jeremy Scott. Governor J.B. Pritzker this past Thursday issued a stark warning: if COVID numbers don't come down throughout the state, another stay-at-home order could be in the works. We take you to his news conference.
If you're choosing to travel for Thanksgiving, it is even more important that you take extra caution in the coming weeks. So over the weekend, we're increasing capacity at our most visited sites, Aurora, Arlington Heights, and Harwood Heights. We continue to build on our testing capability, but as always, we're limited by the speed at which the existing public and private lab capacity can grow and by the physical layouts of these drive-through locations. Still, we intend to remain among the best in the nation in testing. Across the state, we're seeing increases in the number of people showing up at hospitals with COVID each day in every single region. And every single region has a positivity rate in the double digits, none lower than 12.5%, and that's in Region 5, Southern Illinois. On our Wisconsin and Iowa borders, two states that are seeing positivity rates of nearly 40 and 50% respectively, Region 1 is now up to an 18.9% average positivity rate, the state's highest. Over just the last 2 weeks, we've seen statewide increases in every single measure, from cases to positivity, to hospitalizations, to ICU visits, to ventilator usage, to deaths. I want to close today by talking about a topic we've covered during a number of these updates, and that's the role of local officials in our pandemic response. Earlier this afternoon, the city of Chicago put out a stay-at-home advisory to residents starting Monday, encouraging them to avoid all trips outside their home, aside from work and school, and all private gatherings inside residences. The city also implemented a new indoor and outdoor gathering cap of 10 people, along with an enforcement mechanism as our hospital systems face down this new wave. So I want to commend the mayor's decision, because it's never an easy one to make, but it's the right one. I should also note that the city of Chicago is doing better than the rest of the state right now when you compare its current hospitalization levels to those in the spring. So let this be a model for action for the rest of the state. Earlier this week, Sangamon County and the City of Springfield announced that they would reverse course and adopt IDPH mitigations. Enforcement of those mitigations will begin tomorrow, more than 2 weeks after Region 3, home to Sangamon County, reached the metrics to require them on October 29th. On that day, the region reported an 8.8% average positivity rate. Well, it's now at 16.4% today. The average number of people coming into Region 3's hospitals for COVID-19 was 11 per day back then. It's 23 per day now. That's a 109% increase. I commend the leaders in Sangamon County and Springfield for taking this step in the right direction, because simply put, there's just no time left to waste. There are other leaders in Champaign, Urbana, and Carbondale, for example, who over the course of the last few months have taken decisive action in attempting to stay ahead of the increasing community spread of the virus, and they deserve to be commended. To the elected officials who have chosen to disregard public health guidance, those who have stood up at press conferences to question the data and fuel conspiracy theories, those who have taken their absurd crusade to the courts and lost nearly every single time, those who have flat out told the businesses in their communities to ignore what their local and state public health departments and experts, some of the best in the nation, are telling them, what is it going to take to get you to be a part of the solution? Dr. Ezeke and I have stood up here every day telling you the facts. We've had dozens of the nation's leading experts present and giving you the information their epidemiological information, their modeling information. They've stood here with us to show you how bad things can get. We've given you the data here in Illinois and the best studies from across the nation and the globe. We've shown you what this looked like in the spring and how this wave is already worse than that in many regions of the state. What will it take to make this real for you? Do we have to reach a positivity rate of 50% like we're seeing in Iowa today? 50%? Are you waiting for healthcare workers to get sick to a point where you don't have enough staff in the local hospital to cover the next shift? What about if the hospitals become so overrun that you're sick and you're dying have nowhere left to turn? Because I promise you, while you fail to take responsibility in your city and your county, that day is coming closer, and it will be on you. Meanwhile, the rest of us will still do our jobs. The state will do all that it can to help hospitals surge their capacity and find additional staff. Healthcare workers will take up their posts on the front lines as they have every single day since this began. But more people will get sick, more people will struggle to breathe, and more people will die because you've failed to do your job. While good people do the right thing by wearing masks to keep each other safe, elected leaders in some communities have allowed others to infect their constituents because they're afraid of the few loud anti-maskers, or because the elected leaders themselves are anti-maskers. In too many of these communities, responsible business owners have followed public health guidelines, only to see competitors flout the rules and prolong the mitigations for everyone else. There may be a vaccine on the way in just a few months, but a lot of lives can be saved before that happens. And when this is over, there will be an accounting by your constituents of who worked to keep the public safe and who just ignored the science. This is the moment to step up and get it right. Winter is coming. Folks, I've pledged to be honest with you throughout this COVID crisis, and that won't ever change. We're running out of time, and we're running out of options. Our growth in new cases is now exponential. We are seeing current numbers and future projections worse than what we saw in the spring. We're more practiced at responding to this virus now, so we have significant stockpiles of PPE. We have overflow capacity that's already planned by our hospitals, and we have much more testing available. But that won't slow the spread of the virus. Since the stay-at-home order ended in May, we've allowed local governments to make decisions about whether they needed tougher mitigations and enforcement, and we've only imposed certain select mitigations at the state level on a regional basis. Those tools worked where people acted responsibly in local communities. But with many community leaders choosing not to listen to the doctors, we are left with not many tools left in our toolbox to fight this. The numbers don't lie. If things don't take a turn in the coming days, we will quickly reach the point when some form of a mandatory stay-at-home order is all that will be left. With every fiber of my being, I do not want us to get there. But right now, that seems like where we are heading. If you're sitting at home and wondering what you can do to help prevent this and to stop the spread, well, wear your mask when you're out and stay home if you can. And while you're home, give your county board chair or your local mayor a call. Ask them what they're doing to enforce the doctor-recommended mitigations. Ask them what they're doing to keep you and your loved ones safe.
Welcome back to Week in Review. If you're a Facebook or Twitter user, you've probably noticed within the last couple of weeks a high volume of posts being flagged as displaying false or misleading information. Our Dalton Kemper sat down with law expert Ambrose McCall to ask about where the lines blur with that and freedom of speech.
Are Facebook and Twitter allowed to flag and even take down content that they deem to be false or incorrect?
Yes, they are. That is a result of legislation passed in 1996 when the Communications Decency Act was promulgated by United States Congress. It included what's known as Section 230. And in Section 230, what the intent was by Congress was to not have social media platforms treated as publishers. The reason for that, separate and apart from agendas or opinions, is that it is very different from publishing a magazine, a newspaper, or a newsletter. And by that I mean that people interact instantaneously or online as the information they share with other people on social media or in response to articles. So the idea was that if the early platforms were treated as publishers, they would soon be out of business because they could not police the content for being defamatory or libelous. So they were given some discretion to exercise in good faith to moderate, but they were also given Section 230, gave them immunity from being named as defendants in libel and defamation actions. That same immunity also allows them to, for all essence and terms under their controls and conditions and contractual terms, control what's posted on their platforms.
So is there any type of speech protected on Facebook or Twitter under freedom of speech that they wouldn't be able to take down, or are they pretty much just in charge of what is on their platform if they so choose to remove something?
Well, that's a great question, and raises a legal matter that started in earnest in the past 3 years, 3 to 4 years, as to whether or not to treat these social media platforms as public squares. The reality is that currently they are not. So they are not governed by the First Amendment, because the First Amendment governs the government trying to say what should or should not be published or what should or should not be censored, subject to, you're more familiar with the federal communications. The FCC governs broadcast radio or TV, and there are certain areas there that there are some controls on what can be broadcast, but Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms, YouTube, Pinterest, Parler, Reddit, they are not government entities, so they're not governed by the First Amendment.
So these social medias have had this power to basically do this, but some social medias like Parler has said that they won't restrict stuff like this. So basically what I'm understanding is it's up to each social media site whether or not they flag things as incorrect or false or make people aware or just let it go.
Currently in the United States, it pretty much is subject to, in all candor and reality, the ability of people to use social media platforms to put national security risks on the populace. And by that I mean that where it gets even more complex is, are the people posting actually who they say they are? And it's not just Russian operatives or spies for China or other countries. There can be groups that are non-country aligned that can be, for lack of a better term, spoofing, acting like they're somebody else, and they're not. And that has come to light that, for example, certain posts that were allegedly on behalf of Black Lives Matter were not posted by Black Lives Matter, and same for other social protest groups. So the other overlay that makes it more complex is our laws are not the same as overseas. Overseas has different controls that Facebook and others are struggling with, because they are finding that in other countries there's much more concern about, for example, people posting that COVID-19 is not contagious, or that people who are young are immune to it, things of that nature, rather than just the social media platform reacting to that alone.
So do you see, just from your eyes, that maybe, do Facebook and Twitter see maybe that they have some kind of responsibility on their part of making sure that people are not spreading false information?
Well, there's the rub, because it's possible that they may have viewed in the long game, long view version of this, before they got to the current what's false and what's true. We know all the social media platforms have been struggling with hate groups posting on their sites of different types. So then when you get to what's true or what's false about COVID-19, and they make more and more editorial decisions, what was interesting to me in the recent congressional hearings was that while Twitter and others were totally against the government through the Congress tinkering with the Section 230 immunity, I think Facebook may have been acknowledging that some changes in the wind, and they wanted to get out in front of it by saying that they were open to making certain changes, for example, perhaps in order to protect sex trafficking victims and things of that sort. So I think in the next 4 years, we're going to find a Congress that, whether of a divided mind or on some areas where they may agree, will revisit the Section 230 immunity, and I suspect there will be some experimentation underway at some point.
That was actually one of my final questions, was what changes would you see coming if they do examine that immunity?
The thought that comes to mind, and again, this is just a speculation on my part, just like anyone else's, is that given the economic size of these social media companies and given their economic success, that Congress will have to balance, do they want to injure some of their largest successful companies, not just in this country, but worldwide, in the process of also looking at how do regular processes get installed so that someone who thinks that their site was taken down incorrectly or their comment flagged has a regular process to go through, whether it's internally with the social media platform and not buried in 50 pages of terms and conditions and not easy to find on the site for the platform or to pursue. I think that's one of the areas they're going to be looking at, as well as trying to clamp down on the national security angle. It's hard to think they're not going to do that, given the number of rumors and forget about our citizenry, but just false statements posted online by outsiders trying to cause dissension.
Absolutely. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that I should know about legally what Facebook and Twitter can do, basically anything we've talked about?
They each have their own set of terms and conditions and dozens of policies when you go on any of these sites. So while I have not looked at a Parler site deep enough to see what terms and conditions they have, at this point, I would tell anyone who's actively using any of those sites to become somewhat familiar with the terms and conditions so they know what to expect when they post certain things. And they may also know how to voice their concerns and keep their website active. The other part of this, too, is as far as I can see, most of these sites that have been taken down, with the exception of Alex Jones or somebody getting in a lot of trouble on courts over their statements being false, a lot of the people, their suspensions are brief or their accounts get reactivated, so... I think some of the concerns we're getting expressed now are just part of the larger societal anxiety and people reacting and possibly overreacting to every response they get from the social media platforms.
Welcome back to Weekend Review. Hospitalizations for Peoria, Tazewell, and Woodford County on Thursday hit an all-time high since the pandemic started. 162 people were in hospital beds, either with the virus or with confirmed cases of it. Peoria City County Health Department addressed this during Thursday's news conference. We'll hear from Monica Hendrickson, the health administrator, as well as Dr. Keith Knepp, the CEO of Unity Point Health, and president of St. Francis, Bob Anderson.
In just 1 week, the number of cases over a week span was 1,237. And as I reported earlier, we now added 2,127 cases in the Tri-County in just 1 week, doubling it. Our 7-day average daily increase in the Tri-County now is at 304, which is doubled that from last week. In regards to our hospital data, OSF St. Francis Medical Center, UniPoint Health Peoria, which includes Methodist, Proctor, and Pekin, currently have 34 ICU beds in use and 128 non-ICU beds in use, and reporting one death in the past 24 hours. With a total of 162 beds in use, this marks the highest number of hospitalizations our hospitals have seen since this pandemic began. We are now averaging 33 ICU beds daily and 94 non-ICU beds daily. This is not sustainable. If we continue on this path, closures will be the least of the worries for this community. More pressing will be increased mortality or deaths, further health complications, and the overwhelming of our healthcare system. Today, we're here to thank the tireless work of our frontline workers who have given more than just their time and skills. They, like us, have gone through a lot of personal and professional challenges and continue to sacrifice. So let's truly thank them by wearing masks and socially distancing. To speak more to this, I'd like to introduce Dr. Keith Knepp from UniPoint Health Peoria.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Keith Knepp. I'm the regional president and CEO for UniPoint Health in Central Illinois. I'd like to start this afternoon by reading a joint statement from our regional healthcare organizations. Peoria healthcare and community health leaders unite during this global pandemic to share a common message of gratitude to the healthcare workers, frontline workers, and the community at large who have endured great change and sacrifice in all aspects of our lives. This is a message to Central Illinois. We see you. We appreciate you. And together, we will weather this storm and emerge stronger. As we prepared for this pandemic in March, our respective organizations came together to share strategies and information for the betterment of our healthcare workers and community at large as we prepared for the unknown. Today, we want to come together again to say thank you. Thank you for wearing a mask. Thank you for physical distancing. Thank you for doing your part. With the season of giving fast approaching, the best gift you can give your loved ones and your community is to stay vigilant. In order to ensure our medical facilities have the capacity to continue caring for patients in Central Illinois, please continue to wear face coverings and practice physical distancing. And when making plans to celebrate the holidays, please consult guidance from the CDC and the Illinois Department of Public Health for those holiday gatherings. I want to emphasize my appreciation to the entire community. I've seen this community come together. Most of all, I want to express appreciation to healthcare workers. And I want you as a community to hear from us as healthcare leaders that your healthcare workers are feeling the strain. This feels like the spring all over again when we felt the urgency and the challenges of a new pandemic. You know what's different this time? We're a lot more prepared. We have tools, we have PPE, we can test a lot more people. We know more about this disease even though we don't have a cure. What's different this time is the numbers are so large. The numbers you just heard, we have 3 to 4 times the number of patients in our hospitals than we had back in the spring. And yes, we still have some beds available, some ICU beds, some ventilators. We haven't tapped out our physical capacity, but we only have so many staff. And we only have so many ICU staff and respiratory therapists and critical care physicians, and the whole country is facing this. I don't know where we would find more. And our staff was tired coming into this. They've been working long hours through this pandemic. So They need your support. We need your support. If we're going to make it through this together, we all have to do our part so that we aren't overwhelmed with more patients than we can care for. So again, we express our gratitude. Let's remember, we are not the enemy between ourselves. This virus is our enemy, and we need to come together to conquer it. So with that, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Bob Anderson, president of St. Francis.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Monica. I too would like to thank our healthcare workers, our providers, and all the specialists that have really been tirelessly fighting this virus for the past months. Our healthcare systems are ready and prepared to care for those in our community, but we need the community to do its part as well. We're getting ready to enter into a long winter season, and we're all tired. We're tired of the pandemic, we're tired of masking, but we can't give in to pandemic fatigue. We must continue to follow the three W's. Remember to wear your mask, wash your hands, and watch your distance. Each hospital has emergency operations plans that it uses to prepare for situations like this. Those plans include how we surge our capacity so that we can care for more patients than we normally do. But those plans require us to have healthy staff available. And as Keith just mentioned, if we don't have the staff, we run the risk of not being able to meet the needs on a timely basis that our communities have. At this point, we're doing okay, but we need to remain vigilant. I encourage everyone to take advantage of virtual health technologies, digital health assistance, websites, and to reach out to their primary care physician if they have concerns, and to use those digital mechanisms before they go to an emergency room to seek care. It helps us to triage your needs and to make sure that you get care at the right place. With that, I'm going to turn things back over to Monica so she can handle any questions you might have.
Hendrickson was first asked her opinion on businesses and individuals not following the mitigation protocol.
So in regards to the mitigation efforts that have been pushed forward, specifically for Region 2, which is where Peoria and Tazewell counties are, you know, there's been a lot of focus, I think, on restaurants and bars and whether or not they're complying or not complying. You know, here in Peoria, we do everything on a complaint basis. We use our Restore HOI website to log in complaints, and then we reach out and do education, because a lot of times it's just understanding the implications of when you don't follow the mitigation rules, what can happen in terms of licenses, whether they're liquor licenses, food licenses, as well as the DCO issued a lot of grants and funding activities. And so again, people really don't want to jeopardize that. And so a lot of it's just education on our part. But I can say, overall, the thing that you can do as a community is recognize the fact that the virus spreads, and it spreads based on the concentration and volume of individuals. So by wearing a mask, and there's some great information now from the CDC about the importance that wearing a mask is actually really about you and others, but there's a lot more about how it can protect an individual. Likewise, that social distancing, you're gonna be able to get ahead of it. So I know there's a lot of questions about the levels that people are following it, but overall, again, it takes a whole community effort on this.
Hendrickson earlier said the Tri-County has been experiencing 300 COVID-19 cases a day. In the past, she says if it ever reaches 500 a day, it would become an uncontrolled situation and contact tracing couldn't keep up. She was asked about that.
So I think there's two parts to understanding the uncontrolled situation. One is the effectiveness of contact tracing. So local health departments across the state have been just increasing their workforce around contact tracing, as well as leveraging existing points of contact. So training congregate living settings, working with our shelter population, our school districts, because a lot of them are the first line of defense in some of this recognition of who those close contacts are. But to really help our contact tracers and really control that number is exactly what we've been saying in terms of those non-pharmaceutical interventions and what both hospital systems have said today. It's you got to wear your mask and you have to maintain social distancing.
Welcome back to Week in Review. With the COVID-19 resurgence, not just in Illinois, but all across the nation, there's been a decreased amount of bed capacity in hospitals. There's been a decreased amount of PPE. And just as important, there's been an increased amount of a fatigued front line. Unity Point Health President and CEO Dr. Keith Knepp joined WMBD's The Greg and Dan Show on Tuesday to talk about just how much of a toll this is taking on his hospital bed capacity and his workers.
Keith, good morning.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. There is an uptick, of course, locally in COVID cases, and our positivity rate keeps sneaking up, and there is worry about hospitalizations increasing and how that impacts everyone. Give us a snapshot of what you're seeing and feeling.
Yeah, thank you for having me on and the chance to share what we're experiencing. You're right, there's an uptick. In fact, I think it's accurate to say there's a surge. As you probably saw, Illinois hit over 10,000 cases across the state for last four days in a row, and Central Illinois is no exception to that. And we're definitely feeling it in the hospital. Many more patients in the hospital right now than we had even in the springtime here in Central Illinois.
And a lot of people don't understand, Keith, the fact that if you even fill up most of the ICU beds with just COVID, if people have appendicitis or other things, it's going to limit the room. I mean, is there a metric just for ICU that you say, we don't want to go over this because we need to keep emergency beds for other situations?
Yes, absolutely. And we look at all those things. We look at the occupancy of our hospital in general and how full the intensive care units are. And we are, again, making decisions like we did in the spring to limit other things that we have control over. So we've postponed some elective inpatient surgeries this week just to make sure that we are saving a little bit of capacity for what we can't predict.
I have two questions. One is something that you referred to is the number of hospitalizations, but does that mean ICU necessarily, or are our cases now, your understanding, your team's understanding of how to treat people, limiting the number of people that are on ventilators and all that? I know ventilator use is way down, but because of some other reasons, but are we talking ICU or are we just talking general hospitalizations?
No, we're talking both. And definitely the overall numbers are up more proportional than the ICU numbers. We have 3 to 4 times the number of general hospitalized patients from COVID right now than we did in the spring.
Wow.
And maybe double the number of ICU patients. To be clear, one thing I want everybody to hear, our biggest challenge is the strain that this is putting on our healthcare staff and our healthcare teams. We have more rooms, we have more ventilators, but there's only so many people that have the specialized training to take care of ICU COVID patients. And our ICU team members were tired and stressed 2 weeks ago before the surge hit, and even more so now. So there's only a finite number of those folks, and they're already they've put in many, many, many months already.
What can we do? What can we, the public, do to help that team?
I think everybody should act right now as though everybody they are spending time with or coming in contact with might have COVID, because it's possible that they might. So, you know what the measures are that we've all been talking about.
Sure.
I think particularly as we head into the holidays, you know, a really tough thing to contemplate because everybody's tired of this is, well, what about family Thanksgiving? What about Christmas? Right. And isn't it time we can finally get back together again? And boy, I sure wish it was, but I'm afraid we could really be in trouble if we all bring a bunch of people into a small room together for a few hours.
You know, if you think about it, and it's been, 7-8 months that we've had to deal with this, although we've kind of loosened things up a little bit. But for Thanksgiving and Christmas, if you could just go one Thanksgiving and one Christmas with just the immediate family, there's great signs of antibody research out there of a possible vaccine. This is not permanent. We just need to really buckle down short term.
Absolutely. You know, promising news just this past week about vaccine development, and I'm confident we'll get ahead of this. It's just that we aren't there yet.
Yeah.
I think the other thing I would comment on is, particularly coming out of the election, let's all remember that the virus is the enemy here and not each other.
Yeah.
We're tremendously grateful to live in Central Illinois and to have the support of the community. And we do want to express our gratitude for all the people that are still doing the things we need to do to support each other, keep each other safe. So let's keep that up.
You know, you talked about a couple times now, you've referenced that we're numbers higher than we were in the spring and so on and so forth. I have two thoughts about that. One's an observation, and then one's a question to you. My observation is, I feel, just from the world that I am around and people that I talk to, is that people don't feel that way, that the reality of this surge has not set in, and that, in fact, you mentioned a minute ago talking about Christmas and Thanksgiving. Well, I'm just so tired of it. I'm ready to be done with this is a phrase that I hear all the time. Well, that doesn't make it go away. That's just my observation. My question to you is, obviously, your teams are way better equipped than they were back in March and April. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so there are a lot of things that we have at our disposal that we did not have in March and April. We do have enough PPE as it stands today. We have the ability to test folks that are symptomatic. We know more about treating this disease. Unfortunately, what we don't have is a medication that is guaranteed to make it better. So we know we can give some steroids. We know we can give remdesivir. We have convalescent plasma. But despite that, we still have patients who end up on ventilators and don't survive. And yes, some of them have underlying conditions, but boy, there's some that don't. And it's hard to predict that. So we're definitely in better shape than we were in the spring on those things that I mentioned. But unfortunately, that doesn't mean we have all the capacity that we need if we don't all do what we need to do.
And are you finding, as we hear more and more stories, that people who actually do get it, and get it fairly severely, have long-term implications, whether it's swelling on the brain that leads to headaches and hallucinations, to scarring in the lungs and tissues? Are we finding out that the people who had it earlier this summer still have some lingering effects?
Yeah, it's different for every person, and certainly many people have mild symptoms and get better, or are really ill and get better. But this virus has complications for some people that does cause long-term effects, unfortunately. You know, the clotting issues, strokes that can happen as a secondary side effect. So, again, it's really hard to predict, but for a few unfortunate people, this can be long-term sequela.
Well, Keith, we want you to know that, and pass this on to the folks. They're probably so exhausted it would just be noise to them, but we do appreciate your team. We appreciate, I have had several people in my circle that have had to deal with this on a pretty severe level. I've lost a couple of folks that I know. It is devastating, and you guys are the frontline army that's fighting it, and thank you very much for all of that, because we'd be lost without you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to be on this morning, and I know everybody's tired of this, and we just want it to go away, and what we have isn't we have to deal with the world we have, not the world we want sometimes. But I really, really appreciate the support.
All right, buddy. Talk to you. Keith Knepp is the regional president and CEO of Unity Point Health.
And that does it for another edition of Week in Review. Join us again next week at this time on this Midwest 360 station for another recap of some of the big events and issues of Central Illinois. Special thanks to WMBD News reporters Julia Bradley and Dalton Kemper for their contributions to this broadcast. You don't have to wait for Week in Review to get the lowdown on what's happening in Central Illinois. For NC News 24/7, follow WMBD News at 1470 WMBD on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and at 1470WMBD.com. I'm Jeremy Scott, WMBD News.